From Washington, this is VOA News. I'm Steve Norman reporting. Croatia sent at least 1,000 migrants to Hungary by train and bus on Friday after saying it can no longer register or accommodate the new arrivals. The migrants were in turn boarded by Hungary onto other trains and buses that police say were headed to registration points near the border with Austria. VOA's Ayesha Tanzim has been out among the refugees as they make their way through Hungary.
People are out on the road. They're sleeping out in the fields. Sometimes they get tents. A lot of times they don't. Even when people are trying to help them, there's not enough to go around. We were at this in this border village called Bezdan in Serbia, where the Serbian Red Cross had food and water, but they were only giving it to women and children and people under 18 because they didn't have it for everybody. So the men had to do without food. So the situation and the condition these people are going through, very dire.
A spokesman for the United Nations High Commissioner for Refugees said Friday that the European Union needs to take collective action in the face of the migrant and refugee crisis. Russia's military buildup in Syria appears to be entering a new phase with the arrival of 4 Sukhoi attack aircraft. Total of 8 Russian helicopters have also been spotted, and U.S. officials say Russia now has 500 naval infantrymen on ground in Syria, with more on the way. Coup leaders in Burkina Faso say they have freed the country's interim president as a gesture of goodwill following Wednesday's coup. The African Union suspended Burkina Faso on Friday because of the coup, which sparked protests in the streets of the capital. This is VOA News. Al-Shabaab has carried out bombings in most of the countries around the Horn of Africa, except for Ethiopia. Marta Vanderwolf reporting now on how Ethiopia has avoided attack.
Kenya, Uganda, Djibouti, the self-declared Republic of Somaliland, they have all been attacked by the Somali militant group Al-Shabaab. But Ethiopia, which invaded Somalia in 2006 to fight Al-Shabaab, has so far never experienced a large-scale attack. Tewolde Mulugeta of Ethiopia's Ministry of Foreign Affairs says Ethiopia has been successful in preventing attacks by involving the general public.
So, I mean, whenever they are going to come across any anti-peace element, any anti-peace force, any terrorist force, they are going to expose them, they are going to fight them head on.
It is not clear how many potential attacks Ethiopian security forces have prevented. Marta van der Wolf for VOA News, Addis Ababa.
A group of Taliban militants assaulted an Air Force base in northwestern Pakistan on Friday, killing at least 17, wounding many others. Tens of thousands of Pakistanis have died in the decade-long Taliban insurgency. President Obama had a rare telephone conversation Friday with Cuban President Raul Castro after the United States eased restrictions on travel and business on Havana. Easing comes 2 months after the formal restoration of diplomatic relations between Washington and Cuba, and the day after Cuba announced it would appoint its first ambassador to the United States in 54 years. Pope Francis will try to meet with former Cuban President Fidel Castro in Cuba during his visit today. Then the Pope will be the first one to speak to the joint session of the U.S. Congress when he arrives in Washington next week. Vatican spokesman Father Federico Lombardi said no Pope has ever spoken to the American Congress, and Francis was invited, and he has willingly accepted because this gives him the opportunity to speak to all the American people, he said, through representatives and not just to Catholics. In addition to the visit to the White House, the U.S. Congress, and the United Nations, Francis will meet with homeless people, with immigrants, children, and prisoners as well. And while in the U.S., the Pope will give 26 speeches, 22 in Spanish, 4 in English. And in the wake of the second Republican presidential debate this week, one thing does seem apparent. The long and contentious battle that played out in that debate marked a turning point in the 2016 race for the party's 2016 nomination for U.S. president. For one thing, frontrunner Donald Trump's rivals lost their fear of attacking the billionaire. You can get more on that story on our website at voanews.com.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News.
Welcome to Issues in the News. I'm Fred Barnes, executive editor of the Weekly Standard. Joining me on the show this week are Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. And here are the issues. Russia is pouring troops and weapons into Syria, its Middle East client state, prompting President Obama to reconsider his strategy involving Syria. The issue of Russia, the United States, and the Middle East emerged as a critical issue in a three-hour nationally televised debate among Republican presidential candidates, 11 of them, for the Republican nomination in 2016. Other issues discussed and debated: immigration, a possible American military buildup, and the so-called nuclear button. Frontrunner Donald Trump was criticized heavily during the debate, and former Hewlett-Packard CEO Carly Fiorina drew accolades from the media. Well, Tom, let's start with Syria. But the White House seems to be a little befuddled about what Vladimir Putin is doing, sending in heavy artillery and so on, and troops into Syria. What do we think Putin is up to? Is he just sort of testing the things to see what he can get away with there? I mean, it's not a secret, of course, that he's a great supporter of the current Assad regime in Syria.
Putin's whole modus operandi is demanding respect. This is a leader who has said many times that the collapse of the Soviet Union may have been the greatest catastrophe in the history of the world.
I don't think he said may. I think he said it was.
It was, yeah. All right. So he is determined to get respect, regain respect, and he thinks he can do that by being very muscular and very robust, and he senses that the U.S. is not going to challenge him. He remembers very well that President Obama, as we all know, said that if it was discovered that Syria had chemical, biological weapons, the U.S. would strike.
Yeah.
They did, and we didn't. The U.S. didn't. And so I think Putin just wants to establish himself as a bigger player for whatever happens. I mean, he wants to be positioned so that if Assad has to go or goes as part of a transition government, which I think is not likely at the moment, Russia will still be there to pick up the pieces.
And what is this about the White House is putting out that the president may or may not talk to Putin about this?
You know, there are clever leaks to the press and stupid leaks to the press. This is a stupid leak to the press because it is obvious what they're doing. Of course they're going to talk to Putin. Putin and President Obama can't stand each other. Mm-hmm. It's very clear. But in this day and age, you've got to be able to engage. Mm-hmm. And there's never going to be a warm personal relationship between these two guys, but you've got to be talking to them just as President Obama's going to be talking to the Chinese president when he's here.
Because
Republicans are beating up on the White House. We'll come back to the debate in a second, but at several points in the debate, some of the candidates said, we would never talk to Putin. We just can't talk to him. And so the White House knows they got to talk to Putin, but they want to make it look like it's an excruciatingly close call, and it is so transparent as to be dumb.
You know, Stephen, as I recall, in 2008, when Barack Obama was running for the Democratic nomination and then for president, one of his key things is, I'll talk to anybody. We're not going to just talk to our allies. We're going to talk to our adversaries as well.
Right. Well, he's done plenty of talking to adversaries. And if you talk to allies, there's plenty of allies that would have liked a bit more talking with the president. But put that aside, I think it's Tom is right that President Obama and President Putin can't stand each other. President Putin doesn't respect the president, never has. President Obama never liked him. He sees Vladimir Putin as a thug. He sees him as somebody that's taking decisions which in the long run make absolutely no sense for Russia. I think one of the big deficiencies of this administration is the way that they underestimated Putin's potential to cause havoc. They basically took Russia's demands for respect and calculated that Russia is a fading regional power. It's been debilitated by the fall in oil prices. But Russia still has a lot of capacity to make mischief from the U.S. point of view. And this is something you're seeing. You know, Tom is right. Russia has long had links to the Middle East. It wants to be seen as a player. For years in the Cold War, it had a naval base, a warm water port in Tartus in Syria. And it's exactly right that Putin sees a chance to leverage this situation in Syria to get to the top tables of international diplomacy again.
You know, this was one of the big issues that came up in the Republican debate. It was held at the Ronald Reagan Library and Museum and Hangar as well, since they have both Air Force One, at least one of the Air Force One versions that carried the President Reagan around, and also the Marine One, the helicopter. But one of the things that came up, as I was getting to, was the question of Syria and what the Russians are doing. There was sort of a confused response by Donald Trump, the billionaire who's running for president very strongly at the moment, well ahead in the polls, running for the Republican nomination. And here's what Marco Rubio said, who's very good on these foreign policy points, and he's a senator from Florida. He said, well, first of all, I have an understanding of exactly what it is Russia and Putin are doing, and it's pretty straightforward. He wants to reposition Russia once again as a geopolitical force. He's trying to destroy NATO. He is trying to replace us, meaning the United States, as the most important power broker in the Middle East. To which, I'm reading from a Wall Street Journal editorial, to which the editorial writer responds, exactly right. Stephen?
Yeah, I mean, it's difficult to argue with that. The question becomes, you know, after you've defined the problem, what are you going to do about it? I think you could argue that perhaps Iran and Saudi Arabia and Turkey are more important power brokers in the Middle East than either the United States or Russia these days. But what are you going to do about it? Are you going to recreate the conditions of the Cold War? Are you going to send divisions to Eastern Europe? Are you going to bolster the Baltic allies? Are you going to start arming rebels in Ukraine? Does that make Putin's behavior more acceptable to the United States, or does that just escalate the problem? I think what the real problem is that Russia has seen U.S. actions and U.S. threats and calculated that there's nothing behind them. The question for the next president will be, is he or she prepared to put some steel behind the threats? And then are they prepared to go, you know, all the way through what could be an escalation?
Tom, I'm going to call on you in just a moment, but first a short break. We'll be right back with more Issues in the News.
Do you lead a busy life? Not always able to catch your favorite VOA radio or TV program? If you are keen to stay in touch with world news and events, give VOA Podcasts a try.
VOAnews.com.
Visit our website at VOAnews.com to learn how you can become a subscriber to VOA Podcasts and keep your life up to date.
VOA News, your trusted source for news and information.
Welcome back to Issues in the News on VOA. I'm Fred Barnes with Tom DeFrank and Steve Collinson. Tom, you wanted to respond to, I guess, what Rubio said, Senator Rubio said, and what the Wall Street Journal said.
Well, I agree with most of that editorial that you read, Fred, but I don't agree that Putin wants to destroy NATO. What do you, because that's going to be impossible to do.
Well, how about neutralize NATO?
What he wants to do vis-a-vis NATO is to make sure that Ukraine and other former Soviet satellites don't get into NATO, and I think that had a lot to do with his annexation of Crimea, and it had a lot to do with his moving troops and material and arming thinly disguised insurgents into eastern Ukraine. I think that's his main goal. But the overriding goal is to show that they may not be a superpower anymore, but you'll never be able to convince Putin of that case. He's flexing his muscles, and he thinks both President Obama and NATO will blink, and he's going to just see how far he can go.
You know, basically, Tom, since World War II, the United States has been the dominant power in the Middle East. Is it really conceivable that Russia could supplant the U.S. in that role?
I think it's a little hard, although they've got plenty of capacity for mischief, as we see in Syria. They're probably going to be selling a lot of oil supplies and other things to the government of Iran once the sanctions come off. They are going to be more of a force, more of a power, but I don't think they're going to be able to supplant the U.S. in the Middle East. Jordan and Saudi Arabia are not going to be playing ball with the Russians, and the Egyptians really are not either. So I think that would be their goal, but I don't think that's going to happen.
Stephen, you're a reporter for CNN, and this was a CNN debate. It went extremely well. I don't mind if arguments and fights break out among the candidates. They disagree on a lot of things. I was fine with that. But 3 hours?
Yeah, that was a long time. I remember I was watching in Rubio, for example, I mean, he was absolutely sweating after about an hour. And it was really hot in there, yeah. not to mention just the length of time. In fact, I think this was one of the reasons why perhaps someone like Donald Trump had less of an impressive performance than usual. He's not used to being out there for 3 hours. Yeah. But there was a period in the middle where he seemed to disappear for half an hour, and he was kind of leaning on his podium. And, you know, at the end, he seemed a little bit chastened and a little bit humbled. I think it was an examination of political skill, and it was one indication. We've been through a campaign where outsiders like Carly Fiorina, Donald Trump, Dr. Ben Carson, the neurosurgeon, have done very well channeling anger against Washington and the establishment. But what this showed us as well is that the political professionals do have some game. You know, it's a tough thing to stand up there, argue about policy for 3 hours, and it was an examination, I think, of the kind of person you want in the White House. Donald Trump at times was exposed because he just didn't have the detail at his fingertips like someone like a Rubio or a Rand Paul or a Chris Christie or someone that's in professional political life had.
It particularly seemed that way, that his knowledge and the quality of his analysis were particularly thin on foreign policy.
Right. But having said that, I was at a Donald Trump event in Dallas on Monday in a basketball arena, 22,000 people. Yeah. I spoke to a lot of the people there. And I said, does it concern you at all that he doesn't know about foreign policy, anything like this? And they said, no, we don't care. It's not about foreign policy. It's about being tough. It's about standing up, talking to people like Putin in a, you know, with tough oratory. These people have to understand we're a great nation. So in some ways, we can sit here and pick holes in the fact that, well, Donald Trump doesn't know much about Ukraine or nuclear policy, but his supporters, and that's probably not going to be enough to get him elected, but he's got some core, faithful supporters who don't care, and they actually like the fact he doesn't know anything about policy.
Tom, I'm going to get your analysis of both Trump and Carly Fiorina. Start with Trump. Well, it was not a good debate for him. There were no, I don't think there were any gaffes, but he had to change his view of, he criticized Carly Fiorina as her looks not being good, and he had to change that and say, oh, she's incredibly beautiful. But what about else? I mean, he took some hits from Jeb Bush and from Scott Walker, the governor of Wisconsin, and all in all, he didn't seem to dominate this debate as he had the first debate, and indeed the entire campaign.
He took hits from just about everybody, with the exception of a Texas Senator, Ted Cruz, who believes that when Trump craters, if he craters, that Cruz will be the beneficiary of most of those rabid supporters of Trump. But I agree, it was not a particularly good debate for Trump. I found myself, after three or four instances of him saying that, showing that he was pretty much content free on policy. I remember a very famous Richard Nixon line in the 1968 election, which he said he had a plan to end the Vietnam War, but he never told anybody what it was. It was a secret plan. It didn't amount to much. Trump doesn't have secret plans. He kind of has no plans.
Yeah.
Well, I'm a big admirer of Jake Tapper, the moderator, admirer.
He did a good job.
But he did not pin Trump down on, which is hard to do, but he didn't pin Trump down on the business about, all right, if you're going to throw out 11 million illegal immigrants in the United States, how in the world are you going to do that? We'll come back to that.
I don't think
it was very good. Yeah. I think Carly Fiorina was very good. She was poised. She was polished. She had specifics. And I think she helped herself. The real question is, she'll go up in the next round of polls. Who will lose support? And I suspect it might be Ben Carson. He might lose a bit, and Carly Fiorina will pick up some. But she did very well. Trump was, I wouldn't say the bubble burst, but there were starts to be, there were a few cracks in the facade.
Well, it certainly hadn't burst in Dallas yet.
That's right. No, that's for sure.
And Tom, you're from Dallas. Well, you couldn't be surprised.
Dallas is, to use a bad metaphor, Dallas is ground zero for those kind of people.
Right.
These are people, you know, there are people in Texas, and I'm from Texas. I love Texas.
You're from Dallas.
There are people who would be just as happy if Texas seceded from the Union.
Well, that's not going to happen. Well, where should we go from here? Let me ask you about the candidate who has been, I think, the most criticized for a really weak campaign, and better was expected, is Jeb Bush. You know, part of the so-called Bush dynasty. And I thought he did pretty well, but I've read what other people who watched the debate thought, and they weren't as impressed as I was.
Right. My perception was Jeb Bush did better than he did in the first debate, perhaps showed a bit more life in than he had so far in this campaign. But Jeb Bush has a fundamental problem. His base in the Republican Party is rich donors. You know, I've been to all the early states. I've yet to find anybody that really says, wow, I'm going out there and I'm going to vote for Jeb Bush. He has a real problem, and I question where he's going to win, which one of the four early states Jeb Bush is going to win. And if he doesn't win New Hampshire, example, yeah. I think he's in a lot of trouble.
He is. He is. I mean, nobody is expecting him to win Iowa, but New Hampshire is certainly a critical state for him. It is time for another break. We'll be right back with Issues in the News.
Need a little straight talk? Want to make sense of the world around you? Ask a question. Hear what others have to say? If so, Voice of America has a variety of talk shows for you. Lifestyle, health, politics, youth, sports. We have it all. Tune into our discussion shows on the radio, TV, or the internet. They examine a wide variety of issues and world events not always covered by other media. VOA.
Welcome back. I'm Fred Barnes, and I'm with Tom DeFrank and Steve Collinson. What about the immigration issue? You know, this was one of the issues, as Tom pointed out, that Donald Trump didn't have any plan for how I'm going to get this 11 or 12 million illegal immigrants in the United States out of the United States. I also wish he'd been asked, he was citing on this issue, he'd been denouncing, Trump had this idea of if you're born in America, you have a birthright to become a citizen. And he complains that, you know, foreigners come in and they come over the border, the baby's born, then they move back to their country. He said, oh, there are many, many scholars who have said that this right doesn't really exist. And I wish I'd ask, name one.
Right, right. Well, you know, there's this big debate in sort of, you hear it a lot on conservative talk radio about the, what exactly the Constitution means, yeah. What various amendments means, we don't need to get into here. But, you know, the interesting thing is this idea of Trump's still has a lot of currency among people that support him, that somehow we can deport 13 million illegal, mm-hmm. I think we're supposed to call them undocumented migrants now, or whatever the phrase is. You know, if you think about what that would mean law enforcement, you know, officers from the U.S. government rounding up people, kicking them out, pursuing them. It just is incomprehensible that that would happen. So this is kind of symptomatic of the whole argument in the Republican Party that's you know, fostered by this issue of immigration. And I think it's an issue that's sooner or later it's going to harm the Republican Party. The Republican nominee is going to get stuck with all this stuff about immigration that's being thrown up in the primary. And the Democrats, you know, there are several, I think Carly Fiorina was saying in the debate that the Democrats actually don't want to solve this problem because it's such a boon to them every election when they can whip up the fervor against Republicans on immigration and do very well among Hispanic voters. So it's a real conundrum for the Republican Party. You've had guys like Marco Rubio who tried to solve this. He backed comprehensive immigration reform in the Senate, found out it was politically impossible. Now he's in favor of some kind of piecemeal way of doing this, you know, build a fence, reinforce the borders, then perhaps get to some kind of citizenship. But it's a real problem, and these debates, while it is a fiery issue driving this campaign, are not providing any kind of solution.
You know, Tom, it still festers a little, at least among the Japanese American community, what happened during World War II when how many of them were put in a concentration camp in California? 50,000 or something like that? And here we're talking about 13 million.
The magnitude boggles the mind. And, of course, one of the many things Donald Trump hasn't explained is how do you identify all of them? Because what are you going to do? Just start sending law enforcement teams into every major city in America looking for Spanish surnames and then trying to figure out whether they are here illegally or not? It's just kind of crazy. I find it interesting that after the 2012 presidential election, the Republican Party did an autopsy, if you will, of why they lost. And one of the major conclusions was we alienated Hispanics, we alienated women, and we alienated African Americans. And I don't think they can do much about African Americans, but they're continuing to alienate many women. And they're certainly, with this sort of rhetoric, they're alienating Hispanics, which is still an enormously populous and growing demographic.
You know, I'm one of those who believes in the unofficial sort of number that the Republicans need to get about 40% of the Hispanic vote in order to win. Mitt Romney got 27%, and George W. Bush got 44%. But there's a big distance there, and I think at the moment they're closer to 27% than they are to 44%. Let me quickly do a couple other issues. Intervention in Iraq in 2003 and Syria now, there was a minority that is against intervention.
Right. It's still fascinating.
Among the Republicans.
It still fascinates me that, 12 years since the invasion of Iraq, we're still debating the invasion of Iraq. That is testimony partly to the fact that the war went on a lot longer than a lot of people expected. But it's the invasion of Iraq is conditioning everything in U.S. foreign policy still. It's conditioning why President Obama perhaps didn't do more to intervene in Syria when he called for Assad to be ousted. I think there is some political pay to be made, even in the Republican Party, for being against interventions abroad. You've seen Rand Paul try to sort of plow that furrow a little bit.
Yeah, they did the debate after Donald Trump said, well, I was against the Iraq war from the beginning. I'm the only one on the stage who was.
Right, and that seems to be, and perhaps he was against it, but it doesn't seem to be documented evidence that he was coming out and campaigning against the Iraq war.
Well, that's when Rand Paul stepped in and said, au contraire, I was against it too.
Right, and even those who are in favor of a more robust U.S. policy in the Middle East, among the major candidates, they've not actually specified very much what they would actually do other than send special forces and trainers and operatives into Syria to sort of target airstrikes more effectively against ISIS. And I think that's a recognition that there's no big public appetite in the United States to get deeper involved in Syria. That's one of the reasons why President Obama has been able to sustain this policy of non-intervention. Only one Republican candidate, I think Lindsey Graham, is calling for 20,000 U.S. troops to be sent to Syria. Even that, look how many troops there were in Iraq at the height. What was it, 250, 300,000? That couldn't stop an insurgency. So this is one of those issues that gets debated in presidential election campaigns. Somebody has to be president and actually take decisions based on reality rather than campaigning, and they're going to find it's a lot less easy to solve than it looks from a debate stage.
Remember, for years, Tom, we had what was called the Vietnam syndrome. Since the U.S. had ultimately lost Vietnam, it was it made Americans skeptical about any armed interventions elsewhere. Now I think there's an Iraq syndrome.
Exactly.
That Stephen didn't call it that, but I think that's what he was talking about. And if not, he'll correct me later.
Which clearly spilled over into policy in Afghanistan, and clearly has some impact on a Syrian intervention. I think President Obama does not want to send significant amounts, numbers of American ground combat forces into Syria, and I don't think he will. And I didn't mention this earlier. I think it's going to be harder for him to do that if he ever decides he needs to do it because of more Russian troops and aircraft in Syria, too. I mean, you can imagine what would happen if an American airstrike, for instance, going after ISIS, kills some Russian advisors. So it's tricky and it's a mess. And I think Syria, what to do about Syria will be something the next president's going to have to deal with.
Yeah, what a mess. Okay, here's one that that interested me because it came up right earlier in the debate, and that's the nuclear button. You know what the nuclear button, of course, is? Something that's in a briefcase or that is carried around by somebody with the president and would allow, I guess, if the button is pushed, to provide a nuclear response. In the debate, Carly Fiorina was asked whether she thought Donald Trump was responsible enough to, as president, have these nuclear codes in his possession with the possibility of using them, and she ducked it.
She did duck it, but you get the feeling that that somebody whose persona is to punch you in the mouth at every opportunity, either literally or rhetorically, is probably doesn't have the right temperament. On the, you know, you do have a Secretary of State and a Secretary of Defense and others, but still, the launching of nuclear strikes is a prerogative of the Commander in Chief. And I think the Republicans, other Republicans, are starting now to very carefully make the point that, in their view, Mr. Trump is not temperamentally suited to be the leader of the free world. And you got to be careful about that. But I think we're going to see more of that, not less.
That's all the time we have. Joining us today were Stephen Collinson, senior reporter at CNN Politics, and Tom DeFrank, contributing editor at National Journal. This program was produced by Anya Zalewski. Our engineer was Justin Thwaites. I'm Fred Barnes of the Weekly Standard. Thanks for listening.